to the Semiconductor Insiders podcast series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. With me today is my podcast partner, Mike Gianfagna, and our guest is Terry Daly. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Dan.
And good morning, Terry.
Good morning to you both.
Terry has an engineering degree from West Point Military Academy and a master's in international economics from the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He started his 30-plus year semiconductor career at IBM, then moved over to GlobalFoundries before the acquisition. Terry is now a senior fellow at Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, which makes him the ideal person to talk to about the semiconductor supply chain, chip shortages, and the CHIPS Act. But first, Terry, tell us how you went from being a captain in the U.S. Army to semiconductors.
Well, it's a different trail. So, after active duty, I did get a master's degree from Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I joined IBM. You know, I got very interested in, international business and international, private international law. I felt the best way to understand international business is to get it from the inside out. So I joined IBM. And this was, kind of IBM's peak of being in the PC business. And I got very interested in, the technology and chips. So I quickly migrated within IBM to IBM's, was the microelectronics division, and spent the majority of my career there. And then when I had the opportunity, I, made the move to GlobalFoundries.
Well, that brings us right to the topic at hand. Everybody's talking about it, chip shortages. Terry, in your view, what caused the chip shortages we're experiencing today?
Well, there's obviously been a lot written on this topic. At the core of it, was COVID. And, we know COVID was a black swan event. It had different impacts on different sectors of the economy. We all know at a very personal level, the kind of work from home, educate from home, entertain from home implications of COVID. With that, demand for video connectivity apps, think about Zoom, and the supporting electronics platforms, PCs, games, monitors, et cetera. There was a spike in all of that as well, and other networking and medical device platforms. But it also drove huge demand for internet and cloud infrastructure. On the other hand, in the auto sector, demand in early COVID tanked, and the automakers, they hit the brakes, canceled orders, and there was a, cancellation daisy chain down the supply chain. So, the IDMs and the foundries, as they would do, rebalance their production to products that are in demand and stop new wafer starts on, auto-specific parts as well as others. And then the recovery in the auto sector rebounded quicker than really anybody expected, especially the auto industry. They, automakers restored their orders looking for expedited lead times, but at the chip level, the finished goods bins were, quickly diminished, and the cycle time for, production restart and resupply extended way beyond the need. So that's when we saw, the Ford, Toyota, Nissan, VW, and other car makers, they had to scale back output, and, some of the well-advertised plant closures were part of that. There were some other contributors to, the shortages. There was in some way kind of a negative perfect storm. Within 2020, there were fires in both Japanese and Taiwanese factories that are inside the semiconductor supply chain. There was a disruption in some of the raw materials used in semiconductor production. A BASF plant closure in Europe has been highlighted. And there was congestion in, logistics, port facilities, much tighter access to air freight with international, commercial flights being scaled way back. And then, most recently, the deep freeze in Texas that shut down several fabs. So a lot of other contributors, I think at the core COVID, bottom line, it's going to take months to kind of regain a balance of, supply demand across all these industries.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Terry. I think one of the things that is important is people need to understand that the difference between capacity, which is the total capacity of which we can manufacture wafers, versus fab utilization, right? Fab utilization goes up and down depending on need, and you can't just turn it on and off, like a switch, for a day. So, I mean, you explained it perfectly, but, right now, we just need to increase utilization. We don't necessarily need to increase capacity, but, we can we increase capacity every year, of course. But what do you think the chip manufacturers are doing right now to resolve this issue?
Well, they're working real hard. you know, this is kind of a tactical issue, but you know, the chip manufacturing companies are really the experts here. I mean, to the frustration of the customers and the politicians, as discussed, it will take a bit of time. But you know, here's a few things they're doing. I mean, first and foremost, you can bet they're driving their fabs to, you know, improve production cycle times, tool productivity throughput, and increase yields. I mean, this is the kind of bread and butter of fab operations, as you know, and it's already a year-round 24/7 imperative, but you can bet fabs are doubling down on the basics. You know, by the way, and you mentioned utilization, you know, the push for higher utilization and more expedites, which you can bet customers are asking the manufacturers to do, it carries a risk of slowing everything else that's in the line, to slowing that down. But the fab managers and companies, they really know best how to manage these trade-offs and keep the lines optimized. You know, the fabs, you know, they do have the option to reallocate new wafer starts and revise, you know, which products in line have priority when it comes to tool capacity. And, you know, this is what government officials are really asking for at the behest of their constituents. But, you know, there are contractual limitations on fabs to any broad scale revision in these areas. You know, they've made, you know, contractual commitments to customers and they need to fulfill those. You know, finally, from an investment standpoint, in the tactical time frame, fabs can make these, you know, quote, pinch point investments to kind of get the best balance of effective capacity out of the line. So they can do that. And then also a bit longer term, you know, invest in incremental tranches of capacity. But this will typically take more like months, not weeks or days to execute.
Yeah, you mentioned a black swan event. You know, it takes companies longer to design chips than it does for like TSMC to build capacity. So, you know, we really are able to synchronize the needs and the supply and demand of semiconductors. But, you know, a black swan event did happen. And, you know, this is how it goes. So, you know, you mentioned the government. Terry, can and should government jump in to help?
Well, it's a good question, you know, especially whether they should. You know, we've seen a lot of public appeals within the U.S. government, amongst others, to, you know, for investment in the public and private sector. You know, on the public side, you know, there were, I think, recently an article of 8 U.S. governors with automotive production in their states urging President Biden to do more to press semiconductors to address this global shortage of chips. And we've had U.S. senators on both sides of the aisle have called for the invocation of the Defense Production Act to kind of jump in. On the private side, you know, a lot of individual companies have issued public calls for action. You know, industry associations, the Automotive Policy Council, SAA, SEMI, and others. These players, they understand the limitations that government has to remediate these tactical shortages. In my view, honestly, a bit, they're using the shortage as a pretext to double down on, you know, public advocacy for the longer term strategic investment like the CHIPS Act that we'll chat about. US is not alone here. We've seen other governments around the world jump in, you know, with the objective of influencing, you know, chip production priorities, you know, Germany and Taiwan specifically. You know, I think, you know, the political class, our politicians, you know, they feel obligated to jump in and try to save the day. You know, it's appropriate for these officials to express their concern and request focus on the part of industry. But they really need to avoid their worst instincts. by example, the use of the Defense Production Act in the U.S., at least in my view, would be both premature and a very bad precedent at this time. President Biden's recent executive order for a 100-day assessment of the supply chain in semiconductor advanced packaging and including some of the rare earth minerals. I mean, this, I think, will potentially be a more fruitful approach to lay a foundation for, you know, understanding the full supply chain, you know, as we face this longer term investment, you know, as Congress moves forward to fund it. So, you know, I think, you know, there is a limitation on, you know, on what the government should do here. One closing thought on this shortage. I think the real long term impact here, you know, and it's a very tough lesson, it really falls on the auto industry and, you know, perhaps some of the other sectors. This was largely a crisis of their own making, at least in my view. And they need to take a good hard look at their supply chain resiliency practices. I mean, look back, I mean, you know, Mike and Dan, how many articles were written on semiconductor supply chain resiliency a year or two ago, right? You know, not too many. I don't think it's been a, you know, a major focus, you know, as it certainly has been highlighted to be now. So, you know, some ideas for the automakers in terms of, you know, what they can and should be doing. You know, I think certainly reestablishing some buffer stocks and getting a focus on kind of kit management. You know, the entire bill of material for electronics for the car is needed to resume auto production. There needs to be a rebalance from kind of lean manufacturing, just in time, and over reliance on that to a balance of just in time and, you know, some buffers just in case. Explore, you know, more dual sourcing to diversify their sources of supply. You know, yes, that will be more expensive, but, you know, that's part of the resiliency and redundancy needed. You know, look at a full top to bottom visibility in the supply chain so they better understand the inherent risks from their direct suppliers, the, you know, the Bosch's, Continental, Denso's of the industry, you know, to have a line of sight fully down through those guys, down to and including the chip makers, the packaging and assembly houses, and critical material suppliers. And I think finally, you know, to take a look at take or pay agreements or some other creative plays to contractually lock in supply guarantees for chips or other components. You know, Tom Caulfield, Global Foundries' recent press interview signaled that this may already be starting. He cited that one third of Global's $1.4 billion CapEx investment for this year is going to be customer funded to lock in chip supply in the coming years. So I think this is not a new idea. I think, you know, some of the customers and fabs may be all over this.
We are the victim of what some call chicken little journalism. You know, everybody's saying the sky is falling, you know, we don't have chips, et cetera. But, you know, on the upside, Terry, is we get a lot more exposure now. And, you know, getting the U.S. government involved in the semiconductor supply chain is quite interesting. You Absolutely. Know, if you look at, yeah, if you look at some of the more successful countries in semiconductors, they're really in partnership with the government. You know, Taiwan is the best example, and Korea and Japan and China for sure. But in the U.S., you know, we don't really have the kind of involvement I think we need. So maybe this is the start of something good.
So we've been talking about U.S. government intervention, and we mentioned the CHIPS Act as well. So, Terry, people have heard a lot about the CHIPS Act. What is it, and where are we now?
Well, good question. You know, and just as an aside before we dive in, COVID, we've talked a lot about, had a lot to do, in my view, with building momentum for the CHIPS Act, you know, really by underscoring the importance of U.S.-based production in strategic industries. You know, Dan knows well, I wrote this piece in SemiWiki, actually, in April of last year, early days of COVID. At that time, the U.S., the world, were scrambling for masks, PPE, pharmaceuticals, and, you know, all the other necessities to respond to COVID. You know, to the dismay of many who had not been paying attention to, you know, the migration of production and supply chain for these things, you know, found that a remarkably high percent, like 80%+, was in China. And this shocked the sensibility of many lawmakers and citizens, you know, kind of how could we have let ourselves become so dependent on China for fundamental products? And I think the same realization dawned on policymakers with respect to semiconductors. Not so much that China held market share for semiconductor production, they do not, not majority share, as you know, but rather that the U.S. had a very small and declining share of production, and dependencies were largely in Taiwan, you know, kind of with the associated risk of China, South Korea, Japan, and other countries. So the Boston Consulting Group, BCG, in concert with the SIA, did what I view to be kind of a seminal piece that laid out the facts very plainly. And you know, outline that there's only, you know, 12% of global chip production is done in the U.S., and then it's down from 39% back in 1990. You know, the U.S. has, I call them global powerhouses, manufacturing powerhouses in the U.S., Intel, TI, Micron, ON, Global Semi, or Global Foundries, rather, and others. It's not that the U.S. does not have manufacturing, but, you know, it is a, you know, a small and declining percentage with respect to global, you know, global supply. Congressional Research Service, they published a, you know, an important companion study in October of last year. And I think at that point, lawmakers kind of started to get it. And these studies really accelerated action. No doubt there was a high level of behind the scenes lobbying by industry associations and some of the key private players. But in the end, the CHIPS Act, you know, was born. We're going to dive, I'm going to dive into the details, but I wanted to get to your second question, kind of where are we today? The act was passed by Congress as part of National Defense Authorization Act at the end of 2020, but it still needs a specific funding appropriation. In my view, it's hard to see now how that's not going to happen. There's bipartisan support. The president's called for it to be funded to the tune of $39 billion. Senate Majority Leader Schumer is a key driver of this legislation, and kind of the fact that GlobalFoundries, Cree, IBM, the CNSE at Albany, University of Albany, the fact that they're all in New York State kind of helps that. And Schumer has recently said that he and a bipartisan group would include the CHIPS Act appropriations in a bill to be introduced called the Endless Frontier Act. And this bill is also going to devote resources to 5G and other R&D priorities like AI, quantum, et cetera. So let's just hope that the semiconductor focus doesn't get sidetracked or diluted, by this expanding vision.
So that's an interesting backdrop on the whole project. It is interesting to see a bipartisan effort like this. I think we see less and less of that kind of stuff these days. So this is noteworthy. So CHIP stands for Creating Helpful Incentives to Produce Semiconductors in America, which is a very catchy title, I have to say. Tell us a little bit more about the details here and how this is all going to come together in your opinion.
Yep, agreed. Yeah, so the goal of CHIPS Act is, to ensure continuing production of microelectronics. And by the way, not just at the leading edge, but across the node spectrum for national security needs. It includes intended to include access for, the nation to state-of-the-art node sizes as well, leading edge through commercial manufacturing. There's a focus on advanced package and test. The bill calls out heterogeneous integration, which our industry knows well. It also focuses on, sensor manufacturing and, has references to variable volume production capabilities. So there's a lot in here. Let me unpack that a bit. It isn't a financial incentive bill. So the intent is to provide financial assistance to those who will invest in facilities and equipment in the U.S. for the fabrication, assembly, test, and packaging and R&D of chips, of semiconductors. Companies that apply for these incentives, the so-called covered entities in the bill, they have to have a documented interest, obviously, in building, expanding, or modernizing a fab. Interestingly, the bill calls to have an executable plan to sustain that facility without additional federal assistance, which I think is a wise provision. The project has to be in the interest of the U.S. and demonstrate, the companies need to demonstrate that they're responsive to national security needs, intelligence, defense, nuclear, et cetera. The act envisions the establishment of public-private partnerships to incentivize the formation of one or more companies, a consortium of companies, to achieve these objectives. And these can be fabs, assembly and test houses, or importantly, fabless companies. And I want to make another point on that in a sec. There is a per project cap of $3 billion. And these funds can be used not only to build or expand fabs, but support workforce development, site development and modernization of the facility, pay for some of the operating costs related to workforce, essential materials and equipment maintenance, and support for the fabless companies. And this is, the bill will enable fabless companies to gain incentives to migrate some of their designs to a fab that is funded by the CHIPS Act. So that's key to ensure the fabless industry is also incented to load these fabs. I mean, you both know there's nothing worse in our industry than an unloaded fab. And so, putting the fab up in place is great. But, having a companion incentive for the fabless industry to, migrate some of their designs. And Dan was talking earlier about the long cycle time for new designs and including porting designs or migrating designs from, a non-US fab into this fab is very key. There's also an intersection with Trusted Foundry and the Electronics Resurgence Initiative under DARPA. So they are making some key connection points there. A couple interesting other provisions, and then I'll stop it. One is that, provision that establishes a multilateral semiconductor security fund. So this is intended to enable collaboration with U.S. partner countries to participate in a common funding mechanism. You know, here the legislation seeks to ensure that any partner government maintains export licensing control or export control, the same policies that are substantially equivalent to the U.S. with respect to restrictions on exports to China. And, you know, China in the bill is called out specifically. I think you're both aware of the Wassenaar Agreement, 42, nation agreement around export control for technology. So, you know, this is, underscoring, I think, the necessity of that. Another provision will establish a national semiconductor technology center for R&D and prototyping of, chips. This is intended to be operated by a public-private sector consortium in concert with Energy National Science, National Science Foundation and others. And there's some call-outs on R&D for this initiative for advanced semiconductor manufacturing design, package, and test, but also materials characterization and testing, virtualization and automation of maintenance of semiconductor machinery, interestingly, and metrology for security and supply chain verification. So this is another key component. One other entity that intends to be created is called the Manufacturing USA Institute to focus on this notion of virtualization and automation of maintenance. So it's a really ambitious scope. You know, there are some guardrails in the bill, if you want to call them that. You know, I talked about the $3 billion, max project award, although there is a provision that, provides an ability with Congress and the president to exceed that. There are various clawback provisions to incentivize project completion. There's a lot of interagency, U.S. government interagency coordination built in the bill. You can see a lot of stakeholders in the government and the administration, and there's congressional oversight. So last point, Secretary of Defense under the bill, which has not been appropriated yet, but he's got until June 1st to submit a strategy and an estimated budget to the President, National Security Council. So Secretary Austin better be well underway. He's got a lot of work to do inside 90 days. He's got a lot of interested constituents, both in government and in the private sector.
Wow, that's a great overview. This is an incredibly ambitious undertaking here. One of the things that occurs to me, though, is with this kind of endeavor, is the U.S. moving away from open, global, integrated supply chains? I mean, is that model changing? Are we going to move away from our allies? And, you know, a related question, will this accelerate decoupling with China?
Good question. Certainly the U.S. with this bill is moving to better position itself to provide security of supply for chips in the national security complex, you know, defense, intelligence, cyber, and space. And I think also, critical infrastructure, you think the energy grid, network communications, et cetera. And also to be, globally competitive in some of the emerging technologies that we know, 5G, AI, quantum, et cetera. I don't see any statement or goal in this bill of self-sufficiency. I don't think it's desirable or even feasible. So I don't think, it's realistic to, that the U.S. is walking away from, this global integrated supply chain model that's been the foundation of our industry for decades now. My view is the U.S. industry will continue to embrace that. Our companies need, access to markets, global markets, leadership technology, think TSMC, global talent. That global supply chain model has enabled the attainment of cost targets, supply chain efficiency, and all this is done in concert with allied countries. Incidentally, the U.S. is not the only one moving in this direction. I've seen the term techno-nationalism used around this, but, the EU is working toward a 25 billion euro investment in semiconductor R&D and leading edge capacity. Taiwan's indicated an intent to invest in the semiconductor equipment industry to remove its dependence on U.S. origin technology, LAM, AMAT, KLA, et cetera, the restrictions, current restrictions that are constraining TSMC's ability to serve Chinese customers, mostly Huawei. India is taking another run at building the semiconductor ecosystem for many of the same motivations driving the U.S. program. And then there's China, notwithstanding some pretty ugly and well-advertised setbacks here currently, it's doubling down on its strategy to develop an indigenous semiconductor manufacturing industry. So the U.S. is not alone in this. To your question on China, I think the relationship with China is going to continue to be pretty tenuous, I think, even across administrations. The U.S. and China, you know, kind of like it or not, we're kind of locked in a contest of systems at this point. You know, China appears to be bent on, you know, certainly regional and perhaps, you know, ultimately global supremacy. A lot of issues and flashpoints in this relationship, whether it's, you know, security, human rights, climate, you know, control of the seas, sovereignty over islands in the South China and East China Sea, you know, trade, the recent border contest with India, control for resources around the globe. You know, these are all, you know, kind of part of one really big issue, and that's whether the, you know, the global post-World War II values and rules and norms that, you know, have been established and have been, you know, institutionalized in the UN and many you know, international organizations governing relations between countries, whether that survives or whether, you know, China will have the ability to kind of act unilaterally around the globe as they see fit. So it's a big issue. I mean, we're seeing a lot of, you know, pressure on President Biden right now to establish, you know, some form of rapprochement with China. We're hearing discussions about compartmentalization of some of these issues, and I've seen mostly in the context of climate, compartmentalizing that from the full relationship. You know, the U.S. shouldn't rationalize success by thinking that trading off security versus climate or trade versus climate is going to resolve the larger contest of system issues. So the U.S. and its allies, we have a strong hand, especially when it comes to leveraging technology leadership. And we, you know, our open model of freedom of access to capital, talent, IP, markets, that's inherent in the open economies of liberal democratic governments. I mean, that's our strength and our foundation. We can't give up on that. But I think we're in for a long haul in the relationship between the U.S. and its allies, you know, versus China.
Thanks, Terry. That's a great assessment of the current landscape. I guess as I listen to your description, the term boil the ocean comes to my mind a little bit. This is a very ambitious project. So I kind of have a two-part question. The first one is kind of direct. What's your view of the CHIPS Act? Will it be successful? And I think a related question, you know, you have people in the U.S. government here diving into stuff that we all know is highly technical, very complex, and the interactions are subtle and sometimes counterintuitive. And these guys don't necessarily have that knowledge. So what are the things that U.S. policymakers should be thinking about as they move to implementation? What are the important careabouts, and maybe what are the blind spots?
Yeah, really good question. And, you know, at a personal level, I'm actually very excited to see this legislation come to fruition. And, you know, I mean, really hats off to the many people in government and in industry who've got it to this point. Still needs to be funded, but I think we should have confidence that'll happen. You know, one worry beat is, you know, my hope is that the U.S. government really develops a thoughtful strategy, you know, prior to deploying incentives. You know, $39 billion is a lot of money, but it can go quickly. And the incentives need to be targeted to fill critical gaps in research and manufacturing capacity across the semiconductor supply chain. I kind of worry that projects will be funded on an opportunistic basis, you know, whoever shows up first or whoever comes from a, you know, the congressional district of a powerful legislator will get priority. You know, hopefully that type of stuff does not happen. But in the absence of a strategy as to, you know, where our gaps are and what we're trying to achieve, it has the possibility. When you think of some of the potential beneficiaries of the program, you know, beyond U.S. government on the commercial side, you know, you think Apple, Qualcomm, Broadcom, you know, Intel, Micron, you know, our semiconductor equipment industry, yes, but also the end use markets. I mean, you know, you think Google, Microsoft, you know, Twitter, Facebook, all the social media, I mean, their entire existence and their business models ride on the technology that comes from the semiconductor company, not, you know, industry, not exclusively, of course, but without chips, you don't have those, you know, those advanced markets. And as you guys know, those companies on aggregate have enormous cash reserves and access to capital, a heck of a lot more than the $39 billion taxpayer investment that we're discussing here. So we should hope that this will be a truly collaborative effort, and that we get, you know, some multiples of private investment on the public dollar. Another one is, you know, the semiconductor research Corp recently published this Decadal Plan for Semiconductors, a very thoughtful kind of roadmap outlining research priorities for the industry. Maybe it's happening somewhere, but I'm not seeing the discussion connecting this piece of work to the CHIPS Act. And, you know, I think, you know, that it should be extremely tightly integrated into, you know, the strategy I was referencing earlier. A couple others, I'm concerned about losing critical mass. You know, when you digest the range of the new organizations that I went through in the bill, you know, the technology centers, manufacturing institutes, multilateral funds, individual investments and public-private partnerships, you know, there's a risk that the peanut butter gets spread so wide that the main objective is shortchanged. And I worry about that from a critical mass standpoint. And finally, I'm concerned a little bit, honestly, about bureaucracy coming from the private sector and looking at the number of U.S. agencies kind of at the table, maybe with different priorities. You know, you've got congressional oversight. You know, speed and effectiveness are critical. And, you know, I think the private sector is well positioned to provide some leadership there. And in fact, I think, you know, we'll need extremely strong executive, business, technical, and program management leadership for the promise of this CHIPS Act to be realized. The leadership of our industry, you know, the Illuminati of the semiconductor industry, they're all backing it and, you know, standing by to help. So let's hope, you know, Washington takes full advantage of what the private sector has to offer.
Thank you, Terry. That is probably the best explanation of the CHIPS Act that I have seen today. We're going to have to stop now. This concludes our podcast. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Terry. And we'll hope to see you guys again. That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.